Ladies and gentlemen, thank you so much for joining us to this episode of Chaser Takeaway, video interviews with a leading expert on a question of importance for the British Army and Ministry of Defence. Obviously, these are discussions between two academics and experts, so they only reflect our own views, not that of the Army or the Ministry of Defence. And today we want to discuss the topic of the Sahel region. It's a huge region featuring some very highly populated countries like Nigeria with some 119 million population. But the region is substantially important for us, not least because we're about to deploy British troops to Mali, but our historic engagement with the region, and also so questions on great power competition, irregular migration, counterterrorism. So while we are consumed by the here and then of this pandemic that the UK and our allies are trying to respond to, there's also a world that is unfolding, which we have to focus on, plan and respond accordingly. So today we have a best-selling author and journalist, Tim Marshall, to help us to explore and unpack this stretch of a continent called Sahel in between the North and Sub-Saharan Africa, a broad range of countries, which obviously we won't be able to do justice, but we can only talk about particular themes of importance for British defense. And Tim is the man for that. His books are read by a lot of us, Prisoners of Geography, and amazing books on the border and the flags. And he's been a great friend and an insight to all of us in this conversation. And Tim, without taking much of your time, obviously you have observed the continent alongside the global trends for a long time, and I know that you're currently writing on similar topics on the Sahel region. What are some of the key trends that you observe that we should be paying attention to at this stage?
Firstly, we need to say, Zaya, that there is only one expert and academic here, and that's you. From a journalistic viewpoint, the trends are fascinating in the Sahel because so much of things that are happening, the problems of the modern world, are all found there. I mean, all of them. The Sahel is a drug smuggling route. The narco gangs from Latin America bring stuff into the ports in West Africa, like Senegal, ship it across into the Sahel proper, up through the Sahara, into Europe. People trafficking, exactly there. Climate change is pushing part of the conflict. The legacies of colonialism still being played out. It all comes together, I'm afraid, in a very, very unpleasant manner in the Sahel, which is why the French have got so involved. And we have got in there, not to the extent that they have, but, you know, we are upping the game in the Sahel. I mean, in the military, probably nearly everybody knows, the French have got 5,500 troops there. They've got special forces there. They've got fighter jets there. Now, we've come in with some helicopters and we're helping to ferry the troops around. There are a few units there. We're training people in Senegal, but we're going actually to the sharp end sometime this year. I mean, real sharp end stuff. And other European countries are getting more involved. Despite all that, I think it's something of a forgotten war. 4,000 civilians killed last year, 1 million people displaced from the West African coast across to the Red Sea. We have a belt of conflict. And so this is going to come onto more radars eventually, which is why I think it's worth focusing now.
And Tim, there's always a background to a lot of these conflicts and issues. I mean, in my previous research project, I did a lot of field work in Nigeria. And when you do visit some of these countries and understand the complexity of their histories and societies and politics, the factors that have shaped them and led them, and it often feels like the immediate context that we see or the crises that we see are just simply outcomes of decades long of policies, internal and external engagements, and geographic factors, as well as factors around environment, the water. And you already hinted at the question of global warming. The Sahel, the desert is expanding in the Sahel and it's reducing, it's forcing people to move in, etc. What are some of the key background themes that our soldiers that are being deployed in defense engagement or to Mali or our policymakers should be thinking about as they think about our future engagement?
If anyone's going down there, make sure you know who it is you're with. For example, if you're with the Malian forces, the probability is that most of them are from the south of Mali. And they will not be Tuareg, who are from the north and are much lighter skinned. And again, those of you've been in Afghanistan, you know, you might have been down in Helmand province with the Afghan army, half of which might be from the Tajik area. They look different, they speak a different language, and yet they're part of an army that's in their own country, but they're almost foreigners. And there's an awful lot of that throughout the Sahel. So that would be the first thing. And this is the legacy of colonialism. Chad is a great example. There's about 200 different ethnicities in Chad, and yet you're supposed to make a nation state out of it. So, you know, when you read the history, you know that the French carved up that bit, the British carved up that bit, it was Upper Volta, and then eventually there were nation states. But within these nation states, there are nations of people who are trapped to a greater or lesser extent. And the Tuareg, for example, in Mali, feel very trapped within the nation state, dominated by Black Africans now from the south. So all that colonial history plays in. And they have their own historical memories of their own empires and who was on top and who was underneath and how things change now. Then fast forward very quickly, because we don't have time, to the Algerian Civil War of the 1990s, hundreds of thousands dead. Some of the key Islamists, the real hardcore that didn't give up after the ceasefire, moved into the Sahara and a little bit into the Sahel region. They got into the people smuggling and the drug smuggling game, and they carried on low-level jihad. And they are the ones that have forged the connections right across the Sahel. I mean, the G5, the core G5 countries, but also every single country in that belt. Then you go to the very near past, which is the Libyan Civil War. Gaddafi, the megalomaniac that he was, wanted to rule the whole of the Maghreb, the Sahara, and the Sahel. He really had these dreams of it. And one of the ways he was going to do it was through some of the fighters from the Sahel. And a lot of the Tuareg from Mali and other places went to Libya, joined his special forces, joined the Islamic Legion, and there were thousands of them. And they were very well armed and very well trained. Now, when Libya fell apart, they don't have a dog in that fight. They just looted all the arms out of all the bases, and they came back down through the Sahara and into the Sahel with a ready-made army of mostly Tuaregs who are influenced by Al-Qaeda, influenced by ISIS, who see this opportunity, jump into it, say, yeah, you have these regional differences, we can help you, and by the way, you're good Muslims and we're good Muslims. And so there's this interesting mix of nationalism and pan-Islamism of trying to recreate caliphates, and they come together, and they came together in Mali. So 2011, Libya falls apart. By the time you get to 2012, the Tuaregs and Al-Qaeda and others are moving down south. They take Timbuktu, they take other places, then they overreach. They cross the Niger River, heading for Bamako, the capital of Mali. And at that point, the French, who don't, let's face it, you know, they don't particularly care about Mali, but they care about the region for reasons we can come on to. And at that point, Paris presses the button, in go the special forces, in go the fighter jets. They drive the jihadists and the Tuareg back up past Timbuktu. And that when we get to the end of 2012. But between now and then, it regenerates, it spreads. And now there is a network from coast to coast for this entire corridor across Africa. And it is spreading, and it may spread into places like Ghana, Togo. It has spread into Nigeria, and it can even reach us to the Horn of Africa, which have, and some of these areas, of course, the British will feel a form of responsibility. And there's also a friendship that we have with the armies, such as Nigeria, which is why we risk getting further drawn in.
And Tim, I think the historic context of this, as well as the complexity of the social fabric of these countries, the conflicts that are there, and the international terror networks that seem to find effective grounds, right? So we already have reports of former ISIS militants even working with their Al-Qaeda peers across the Sahel region together rather than actually in competition with each other. Yeah. We've been fighting against Al-Shabaab since pretty much 2006 on the eastern shores of Africa, but they're still there, they're resilient, they're adapting. So when you take a realistic step back from it and say, well, look, Americans are have reportedly cutting down their intelligence and military footprint on the continent, their training support schemes with other armed militaries in the region, as well as their own forces in counter-terror operations. They're still there, they're still fighting, but it's a much reduced attention with the intelligence capacity, etc. Obviously, the French interest, as you already had hinted, much more West Africa focused. They're not necessarily willing to be active in other places that UK is very much interested in. So this puts UK into a very interesting dynamic, right? So we decided to support our French allies. They are one of our closest military partners. And within this post-Brexit kind of reality that we are entering into, the bilateral link matters a lot. And also it's important for the UK to be able to demonstrate what it can do militarily. 300 military personnel providing intelligence and ISR capabilities that we can do effectively in remote locations is good for our troops. It's good for our country. But realistically speaking, with all these historic problems and real problems, is our interest as the UK, or should our interest as the United Kingdom, be focusing on counterterrorism, maybe stability or peacekeeping? Or should we, like we do in Nigeria, I mean, it really ranks high in our aid and development portfolio, because it's a very important country for the UK. Should we develop a much broader Sahel perspective? David Cameron used to speak about upstream factors of irregular migration. Or do we as the United Kingdom accept limitations and what we can do and stick to our niche, which is this rapid deployment?
You can do both, Zia, because you can accept your limitations, and obviously we have them, you know, with the size of the military and the budget and the issues that are going to come with the military budget because of the economic situation we've recently found ourselves in again. But that doesn't mean you don't take the wider view. But the French will take the lead in that side of Africa, which, I mean, we're going all the way back to the 1880s here in a way, but this time hopefully become as friends. And the British will take more responsibility for the other side. We were hoping, and we're hoping to put a map up, and if we haven't, it is very worth having a map open just to get the geographic scope of it. So, on the big power politics, President Macron of France feels quite strongly that this is a pan-EU and European issue. Because if these become failed states, places like Mali, places like Burkina Faso, you will then recreate the sort of failed state that we've seen in parts of Syria and Iraq. And the projection of violence outwards will ripple, more than ripple, onto all of us. And the outflow of people, you know, we will see hundreds of thousands of people, more than we already have, on the move, and most of them heading north. So he thinks it's a European-wide issue. Of course, the French will take the lead, and he wants more help. And the British, I mean, the British are going to go to the sharp end, whereas most of the forces, Estonia, Czech Republic, with a few dozen, you know, they're doing backup, which is good. The Americans, they kind of do get the issues, but they very much see them as fundamentally European issues. Please sort this out. It's just down, you know, the other side of the Med from you. So they are in Djibouti. We know that. Everybody's in Djibouti. The Americans are also in Niger, and they've got a big base there, and they've got a lot of drones. They've got the Reapers there and the long-distance Reapers. And when you put their drones and the French drones together in the long distance, they pretty much have got the combat area covered, which is huge, so huge that you need the drones because boots aren't going to do it. Now, as you mentioned, the Americans are looking, I wouldn't say to get out, but they're looking to reduce. And the intelligence gathering they have and the financial clout, well, everything that comes with the US military, that would be very hard to fill. I mean, the British couldn't fill it. So the French are desperately trying to get them to stay. They're reminding them, hey, we're helping you in Syria, et cetera, et cetera. But we all know that the Americans are looking increasingly eastwards, you know, the great pivot towards China, and that is not going to change. So a European perspective in or out the EU is to get the Americans to pay attention and not to go away for various reasons that we've set out. But it will fall upon the Europeans to do more. The British, I do think, get it. You're right about the Brexit issue in that this is an opportunity post-Brexit for the UK to say, look, we do have a role in the world. We can play it with our friends and partners. But the big strategy is that the French view this as a fundamental foreign policy for the Europeans, French-led initiative, big backup by the British. It does go back to history. And it's very important that we go back as friends. And it is worth noting at this juncture that the G5 countries are putting in their own soldiers.
Yeah.
I mean, they have problems. I mean, Burkina Faso, for example, I think it's got something like an army of about 6,000. It's got limited armored vehicles. I mean, you know, there's only so much they can do. And lastly, on the geography, there is a nexus of Burkina Faso, Mali, and Chad, which is the real sort of triangle. But we can go much broader. We can go down to Nigeria. We can talk about Boko Haram if we had time. But, you know, anyone that's really interested in this, I really would recommend studying the geography and the history. Sorry, I've gone on a wee bit. Just one more thing to introduce is the Fulani people as well. I mean, I mentioned the Tuaregs. There's 20 million of the Fulani. They are a nation without a state. 20 million of them spread all across these countries. Some of them are Islamists, and they are a big driving force within the jihadist movements down there. And so when you study the history of the Fulani people and the Fulani Empire, which is pretty much in that triangle I just mentioned, then you start to get to grips with the complexities. And again, if anyone's going to go actually go down there, you know, you're going to make sure you know exactly who it is you're talking to and where they're coming from, because otherwise you will not get a grip on why they're saying what they're saying.
Yeah. And I mean, just like the point you raised, I mean, the whole Fulani question, the pastoralists, the indigenous versus settler questions, herdsmen and cattlemen and et cetera, and how they often trigger conflicts and
violence. And the Fulani, as you know, they are traditionally nomads. Traditionally, you move your herds, mostly sheep and cattle, into the pastures. But if the pastures dry up, you've got to go further south and seek them, and then you're bumping up against people, and then the trouble starts. Sorry. And climate change in the Sahel region is probably the worst anywhere in the world, and it is a serious factor in driving the conflicts.
Definitely, and irregular migration as well all the way to Europe. Yes. Tim, you already hinted at, in passing, you mentioned China, obviously vis-a-vis US interests. Our conversation on the Sahel region thus far focused on us and our allies in Europe and North America, but it's been really fascinating to observe Russia's coming back to Africa, sneaky here and there. China obviously has, for the last two decades or so, more substantial long-term investment and presence. Yeah. Fascinatingly, we've also seen Turks actually coming to Horn of Africa, all across the Rift Valley, Eritrea and Ethiopia and etc. And in Sudan recently, they had some agreements before the Bashar toppled up. So what about these external actors that are not European, that are not North American, they're not within the traditional understanding of who plays a role in Africa? And some people use the language of great power competition with China, Russia, Europe, and United States competing in Africa. I don't necessarily see a competition as such, but I still see the validity of raising question of Russian activities in some countries, Chinese influence, and especially now with the kind of post-pandemic reconfiguration of a lot of discussions on China and Europe, which always been skeptical towards more aggressive American stand on China. You see that conversation slowly altering itself in Europe. Is Africa going to be an area where we see contentions with Russia and China play itself more from now on? Or is it going to be a divide and share of here are the resources that you want to focus on? We're interested in counterterrorism, irregular migration, or energy resources, etc.
I think it is great power competition up to a point. I mean, it's, you know, it is not exactly, and it's not like the scramble for Africa of the 1880s, 1890s. But there is the potential, not for open conflict, but certainly for spheres of influence and people going in with the money and also the military. The Chinese are already inviting places like Burkina Faso. Send your officers, come over to China. We'll teach you a few things. And traditionally, instead of France. When you look at what Russia did in Syria, I mean, it had a little toehold, didn't it? It had a little toehold on at Tartus with a very small base. But when it saw the chaos and the vacuum by the West that didn't grip Syria, Russia saw its great opportunity to jump back into the Middle East, and now it's a player. the base has been enlarged. It's got the air base up north. They're making inroads in Iraq. And they're hardly going to miss this opportunity to try to become a player, a bigger player in Africa. So they are busy watching. And if there was, if the West did take its eye off the ball or just said, we can't do this, you know, we're busy doing X, Y, and Z, or the economy doesn't allow it, Russia will try and muscle in there. China's already in there. I mean, they've got the base at Djibouti, which they've built and are developing. And they're in there diplomatically. They're in there hugely commercially. And they see the region as part of the Belt and Road Initiative. Now, with that comes, this is what the Chinese have learned in the last 10 years. Well, Chinese interests sometimes, you've got to start protecting your people, your workforce. I mean, they did an amazing job of getting their workforce out of Libya in 2011, probably better than anybody. But they've realized that with an economic empire that they're building, you actually do need a bit of hard power out there as well. And they are beginning to put that into place. And again, if we did not, if we do leave that gap, the Sahel countries are not just going to say, well, we'll try and cope with this on our own. They will say, is anyone that can help us survive as a state? And if it's not going to be us, it's going to be the Russians and Chinese, because nobody else is capable of projecting or willing. I mean, you know, Japan is not about to go and suddenly get involved in the Sahel big time, but Russia and China would. So we have a strategic choice there.
Tim, thank you so much. I mean, there's a lot to unpack here and discuss here, but we don't want to take much of your time and our viewers. I think few key takeaway points for me from this conversation is, one is, there is a long historical legacy behind instability, poor governance issues, and there's a geographic context of the climate change, expanding desert, very difficult conditions in that area between the desert and sub-Saharan Africa. But at the same time, a lot of these questions on terrorism, local conflicts that play themselves out with serious implications for us in Europe and to UK directly. And I walk away from this conversation affirmed in the perspective that actually for the United Kingdom, even though it might be quite tempting to look away from that region, we actually not only have a historical engagement and legacy, but also direct interest in the short and medium term to be present there. Anything from narcotics to arms control to irregular migration to counterterrorism. And so therefore, actually UK in this process should be involved and support our allies and work with them. Tim, thank you so much for joining us for this conversation. And thank you so much to everybody who listened to us. And please check our website, www.chaser.org.uk, for more videos like this from now on. Thank you so much.
Thank you.